Hello, this is Jash Shelton, Director of Photography on Homecoming Season 2, and you are listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey everyone, my name is Ben Consoli. I'm a director and owner of BC Media Productions. This is the Go Creative Show, a podcast for filmmakers. So today we are talking with Jash Shelton. He is the Director of Photography for Homecoming Season 2. Now, if you guys know this, that have been listening to Go Creative Show for a while, I was obsessed with Homecoming Season 1, and we had Todd Campbell, the director of photography for that, on the show to talk about his cinematography and lighting and all that. And you guys should definitely see the show and also listen to that episode. Now, I was given a sneak peek of Homecoming Season 2 because, you know, we wanted to talk about it. I wanted to have seen a few episodes before we had our conversation with Jash, but the show hadn't been out yet. And I'm telling you, it is everything that I was hoping for. You know, the follow-up is so good. Janelle Monáe is the star of this one. And we talk a lot about, you know, working with her, what she's all about. Cinematography is perfect. It's just so good. I love this show. And I know you guys will love this episode because we talk all about the show and how he achieves that just such a good, distinct look. We just dive into a whole bunch of stuff. And I know you guys are going to love it. This episode is sponsored by MZ, Education for Creatives, and PostLab, stress-free collaboration for Final Cut Pro 10 and Premiere. I want to encourage you guys to subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode, as well as follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, because we give you an opportunity to have your questions heard on the show. All right, let's jump in, because there's so much to talk about, with Jash Shelton, the director of photography for Homecoming Season 2. So I'm here with Jash Shelton. He's the director of photography for Homecoming Season 2 and so much more. We're going to get to all of it. Jash, thank you so much for being on Go Creative Show.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on your show. I appreciate it.
Now, I'm going to pretend that this is a fresh conversation, but we did have it before we talked. But I think people will want to know, where does Jash come from? Is it short for something? What is it?
Jash. My grandfather was James Hilliard Shelton, and his nickname was Jash or Jassy. So I, in turn, for better or for worse, inherited his name and became Jash as well, which was very painful growing up.
Why?
As you can imagine. Well, you know, the best way to explain Jash is, and how to pronounce this, is that it's basically, you know, ass with a J, which was the butt of all jokes growing up and, you know, middle school and high school and all that. Anyway, so I became Jash.
Yeah, but that, I think that little bit, you know, that puts hair on your chest. That little bit of, right, you know, high school bullying gives you some grit.
I have no regrets.
The only great stories, no regrets.
Right, yes.
How are you faring through quarantine?
I'm doing great, actually. It's, you know, it's a little unusual and a little odd, but I was just actually talking to my wife the other day, and I was like, it doesn't feel in many ways that different than kind of the normal period that I have in between jobs. You know, I'm like, really? There's always this downtime of whether it be a week or 2 weeks or a month of this downtime in between jobs. And so in many ways, it feels very similar to that. You know, it's like catching up on all the things in life that you haven't been able to do. And I was actually on a pilot that we were supposed to shoot. Like, I think we're supposed to shooting last week, actually. It got shut down 3 weeks into prep. So, you know, it was like all of a sudden all this, you know, time became available. So in many ways, it's similar. And obviously, you know, it's such a unusual, weird time. So there's that component of it as well. And there's the fact that my son's here and he's homeschooling. So there's a few little variables that are different. But in many ways, it feels similar to just being in between jobs.
Where are you? Where's home for you?
I'm in Studio City, California.
You're right there in the thick of it. What are you hearing from your, you know, union reps? What are you hearing from studios? What are people saying? Like, is there a pathway at all for Hollywood right now?
I have heard such a wide range of opinions. I think the most reliable, I had talked to a producer friend yesterday who's actually in San Francisco, but she was telling me she's had some multiple conversations with the studios from Warner Brothers to Paramount. And obviously one of the biggest complications is liability in terms of us all going back to work and how that would work. Obviously the procedure for safety on set and the protocols. So there's an enormous amount of discussion and planning going on for that right now. But I've heard in terms of actual production, physical production being able to happen, I'm at the earliest, I think Paramount had mentioned that maybe in July, but I, you know, like Warner Brothers is not saying till September, October. So I don't know. I don't see us going back to photographing anything in the near future. And I think at the earliest would probably be, you know, July, August.
I mean, what are people going to,
kind of the wisdom.
What are people going to do? It's so, how do you social distance on a set? It's just, how do you do it?
I don't know. That's the thing, you know, there's like this, you have actors who aren't able to protect themselves. And then you have, you know, scenes with extras and not to mention all, you know, 100 people jammed into one little space on stage. So I have no idea how it is going to be moving forward and what that means. Interestingly enough, though, I've gotten a few calls for in-house commercials, which I think this is unusual, but ad agencies are looking for ways to continue creating content or ads. And so this is very bizarre, but they're reaching out to DPs, knowing that DPs can film and often have cameras and equipment. So I've gotten several inquiries about projects that I would shoot in-house with my family, whether it be a board game or a WhatsApp or, you know, some product.
Oh, you mean in-house, like actually in your house?
Yes, in my house with my camera, with my family. So I've gotten several, you know, inquiries about that kind of job, which is also very bizarre.
But you must just be so excited because we're here to talk about Homecoming Season 2. Now, anybody that listens to this show knows that I was obsessed with Homecoming Season 1. Homecoming Season 2 is coming out on May 22nd on Amazon Prime. But the entire first season is out there now. So you go watch it, get up to speed. Now, when this episode comes out, I'm sure it's already going to be released Season 2. But I've only been given the first few episodes. And I have to say, the show looks amazing. It does not disappoint. And I went in with extremely high expectations. And you've just done an incredible job with this show. So congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you so much. I am equally a big fan of Season 1. And Todd Campbell happens to be one of my closest friends. We started out in the film together in Austin, Texas. So I was just, my mind was blown with Season 1. So I share your enthusiasm.
What was the handoff like? When you get Season 2, obviously you know Todd. So what's the process like to sort of hand off a show from one DP to another, but also main, you know, you want to keep things consistent, but you also want to infuse your own look into it too.
Right. Well, I'll say this is like, first of all, and this is a bit of a detour, but I was in Spain over the summer prior to this show shooting. And I had told my wife and I was like, it's been years since we've been on this vacation. We've been there. And I'm like, there's absolutely no way we're coming home from Spain unless it's the greatest, you know, job of all time with the greatest director and this and that. And it just so happened that we're, you know, on an 8-week trip and we're 3 weeks in and I get a call from Todd and I get a call from Kyle, who is also a good friend of mine, the director who I've worked with quite a bit. And they're like, you know, looks like we're doing Homecoming Season 2 and we want you to come do it. And I was like, this is exactly that job that I said would never happen. And then we would never, you know, come back to the US. We'd stay in Spain. And of course, that job does come through. I mean, it's an amazing show. My friend Todd, who shot the first season, did such a, you know, created such a wonderful, you know, world and experience. And of course, Kyle's directing. I was like, it was the perfect storm. So I, of course, got on a plane and came back home.
Oh my God. Did your wife get pissed?
She stayed. My son and I flew back and she flew to Ireland. She's like, you know what? I have been doing this with you for years and this is always the way it is. So have fun back in Los Angeles. I'm not going back to LA in August. I'll see you in a couple of weeks. So she was gone. I don't think for at least 3 or 4 weeks. We didn't see her till September.
Wow. I mean, that's the life of filmmakers. That just is what it is. It's like the perfect way to plan. The only way you know for sure you're going to get a shoot is if you plan a vacation. That's it.
It is. Absolutely. There is no doubt about it. And this is like a dream vacation. Like it's, you know, I was going to these places like San Sebastian and Barcelona and, you know, these places I've wanted to go to for years. And so I was like, there is no way under the sun we're going to let this get interrupted by work. And of course, it happens.
Well, for good reason. A show like that, you can't pass up.
That's true. Absolutely.
So what's the handoff like? You get the show. What happens then? How does Todd sort of prepare you, get you into the Homecoming family? What do you do?
Well, interestingly enough, it started with Kyle and I went into the office and met with those guys, but before I left for Spain, truthfully.
And just to get everybody, Kyle Alvarez is the director. That's who we're talking about. So
that's right. And I met with Kyle and Micah and Eli about shooting the show. And you know, there was a long discussion, probably the biggest discussion is like, how do we maintain continuity with season one, yet bring some new life and some new, you know, some new visual interests and, you know, create our own thing as well. So there was definitely this very long, extensive, detailed discussion as to how to do that and what elements from season one that we wanted to maintain, as well as what kind of new ideas we wanted to infuse into the show.
Can you walk us through a little bit of what that is? Like, what does Todd tell you right from the beginning about the look of the show and what needs to stay?
Well, interestingly enough, when Todd was developing and putting together the look for season one, I also was doing a pilot. He was at my house here in Los Angeles. And so we were sharing a lot of information at the time. We both ended up, I shot this pilot with a DXL1 with the G-series anamorphic lenses, which is what Todd used for the show as well. So interestingly enough, we were kind of concurrently developing some similar visual ideas nice. Before Homecoming even was photographed. So that was interesting and cool. And then, you know, it looked like I was going to be doing season two, I talked to Todd. We had some conversations about, you know, what that camera package was, what those lenses were. Todd, of course, shared the LUT with me from season one to use for season two, which was one of two LUTs we used for season two. So there was, you know, a sharing of ideas and some technical details, you know, through that process.
How would you describe the look of Homecoming to somebody that has never seen it before? Like what it's such a unique show, especially season one with the framing. Now, I don't know if there's some framing changes in season two. I've only seen a very little bit of it so far, but just sort of describe the look of the show.
I would say, I mean, Homecoming is a very stylized show, and there's many stylized shows out there, but I feel like this, the photography and the visual language of the show is a very heavily weighted storytelling component, probably more so than usual. It's borrowing a lot from the 70s, 70 eras movies, music, production design, sound, kind of the Hitchcockian noir thriller type elements. So it's heavily versed in those, but also injecting a lot of new ideas that Todd and Sam brought to the project. I think that, you know, kind of were an evolution of Mr. Robot that found its way into Homecoming season one. Yeah. So I think if you watch this show, I think you're in for something that's visually very dynamic and very stylized.
How did you take that to season two? Did it evolve in any way? Did you bring something new to the season that's kind of uniquely yours?
I would say the biggest thing that we discussed and we brought to season two was we had a couple different storylines going, just like season one. And we have the story with Jackie, who is Janelle Monáe, where she wakes up, she's lost her memory, she's in this boat in the middle of this lake and has no idea who she is. And so we had that storyline that was parallel with Temple, who was in season one in the Geist headquarters. And so rather than using different aspect ratios like season one, which was amazing and brilliant, and I thought it was fantastic, we wanted to have the same idea but not use the same technique. So what we did is came up with a color palette shift where, in a different LUT, truthfully, where we wanted for Jackie's world to be this very kind of dark, gothic, very blue, very cyan, lots of fluorescence, to contrast the Temple storyline, which is more of the season one, very sun-kissed, bright highlights, a lot of specular highlights. So those were the two kind of parallel visual worlds that we use for season two.
Yeah, and it really does feel, they feel so distinctly their own. They feel cohesive as a show, but right. You know that you're kind of somewhere else. Am I somewhere else in time? Am I somewhere else in space? I don't know, but I know I'm somewhere else. And I think you did a great job of that in season two. And that first, from the first frame of that waking up in the boat of season two, the color, I'm like, oh my, I'm going to be obsessed with this season. I just knew it from the first second. So you see a little bit of that in that color palette. Let's dive into that just a little bit more. Talk to me about the color that you sort of developed in that LUT and what are the elements of it that kind of make it feel so unique.
My 12-year-old son just mooned me through the window of the guest house office. I was going to show you, but he ran off.
That is something I would do even now at 39 years old?
Yeah, no, the same. I mean, he comes by it honestly. I think he's at home school, and I think there's been a few moonies that have happened while he's in online school, you know, so I guess it's touche.
I think that's the first. We've done, what, 200 and something, 220 shows or something, a Go Creative show. That's the first mooning.
Yeah. Sorry, I wasn't able to quickly capture it on camera, but maybe that's better that way.
For the best, yes.
Yes. I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that was perfect. We're talking about the color palette.
Right.
There were two distinct ones. One, like you said, was more of what you saw in season one, that kind of sun-kissed, warmer. But then this new one that you've developed for season two, talk to us about the elements of that and why.
Well, we wanted it to contrast season or the Geist world. So we wanted something that would allow the viewer subtly, as you suggested, to let you know that you are in this different time frame, different timeline of the movie. We came up with a lot of reference material to support that. I think, you know, some of the still photographer like Todd Heido has all those like really amazing like landscape and house shots at night, which are very, you know, very blue, very cyan with these warm highlights. So we kind of used that as a launching point, if you will, to develop that look. We shot some tests. I worked closely with the colorist Walter Volpato, who also was the colorist on season one. Mm-hmm. Another little bridge in continuity there. Kind of to develop this LUT. So we had this very specific LUT, I think it was based on a 5245 film stock that was very kind of blue cyan to start with. Mm. So that was kind of the jumping off point. And then we got into these environments, we worked with production design. It's like, okay, for these particular locations, let's use a lot of fluorescence. You know, we're in hospitals, we're in a bar, and even the exterior locations where at night we wanted to be, you know, to play as much of it at dusk, that kind of twilight area. And I think that's a really good fitting word. And that's a word we use quite a bit, is twilight. Even if it wasn't necessarily twilight, we wanted to have that feeling through that storyline. Mm. We also talked about doing rain effects through the whole sequence, but we quickly realized that we couldn't really fit it into the schedule. So I think there was a bit of rain in there, but a lot of it just turned into like, you know, wet downs and, you know, with like fluorescent reflections and pavement and things like that. So that was kind of the world that we tried to build for that Jackie Alex storyline.
How much more time would a rain effect give you?
I don't know. Like it's I feel like it's kind of elevated television, but it's still a distinctly television schedule. I mean, we're still shooting 5 to 7 pages a day, which is a lot.
That's a lot
for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, believe me, it gave me pause when I looked at the first schedule. So, you know, when you're doing something like that, and we're already, it's a show that, as you know, has a lot of somewhat complicated camera moves, a lot of oneers, a lot of tracking and crane shots. So once we start adding in all the elements and then we added in the rain elements on top of it, we're like, there's just, you know, we felt like it was too much to try to carry that all the way through. Like from the minute she wakes up in the boat, she gets on land, it starts raining, and carry that all the way through to her going into the, the restaurant bar environment. So I think we infused a little bit of there, but we had to like pull back on some of that.
I can imagine. I mean, that's going to happen.
Scheduling realities.
That's going to happen with anything, even big, huge films. It's always going to be a time crunch. But with TV schedules are so grueling. Like they're crazy.
Oh my God. Yeah, it really is. It's absolutely insane. And I think on a show like this, where it is so visually ambitious, and then you combine that with the schedule, it's, you know, it's really daunting.
Now let's take a quick break and talk about MZ. Now MZ is education for filmmakers. Now we're talking about hundreds of hours of high quality video-based filmmaking education that covers everything that you want to know: directing, cinematography, post-production, visual storytelling, and more. Now the education is really top-notch. This is A+ stuff. But that's because the educators are A+. I'm talking about Vincent LaFerre, Shane Hurlbut, Philip Bloom. The ARRI Academy is on there, and so many more. Hundreds of hours of high-quality education by educators that you know and love and respect. That's the key thing. Now, you can go over to mz.com and buy individual courses, yes, but I encourage you to become an MZ Pro member, because then you have access to all of it. And why wouldn't you want access to all of it? Because think about it. We're home now more than ever. This is the time to, you know, dedicate to learning a new skill. honing your skills, becoming better so that we can come out of quarantine better than we went in, right? That's the best way to use this time. And MZ Pro is the way to do it. So head over to gocreativeshow.com/MZ, MZED. Become an MZ Pro member and you will get hours of education by the best people in the business and you'll learn. And that's what it's all about. gocreativeshow.com/MZ, MZED. There's definitely an influence. There's a Hitchcock influence in this series for sure. And you see it in season two. But how do you describe what that is? Like, I think certainly people that are watching this show have seen Hitchcock films, but they're so in the past and they're so in film history now that I think a lot of younger people may not even know that they're watching something that's highly influenced by Hitchcock. I don't think they realize what it is. What are the elements in the cinematography in Homecoming that are Hitchcockian? Like, what are you pulling from his catalog?
I mean, I think the most obvious and literal reference is, I think it is episode maybe two, where Jackie's following Temple to work. And there's this whole sequence in which she is at her house and then she's in her car and she follows into the Geist building. And I think that that one we used, it's very Vertigo-esque. I mean, we literally had frames that we were matching from Vertigo. So it was like almost like an intentional homage, if you will. But I think it's just about, it's for that one, it's about tension. It's about kind of this probing camera. It's very unsettling. You know, literally for us in that sequence, it was the juxtaposition of these shots of Jackie driving in the car and going through these different landscapes. I mean, that sequence in Vertigo where I think, I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. It's the sequence where he's following her in the car.
Yes.
I can't remember the characters' names. But it's a long, it's like a 7-minute sequence. And so they're also very kind of meditative, but captivating as well. So, I mean, you get through that and you're like, wow, that was 7 minutes. Yet I was so intrigued and interesting and, you know, in the landscape and the geography and what's going on with these characters and the viewpoints. I think the viewpoints are a lot of it. The point of view, I should say, is also an important element.
I think the thing to me that is the most like Hitchcock is this unnerving feeling at all times. Like you always feel like something bad is about to happen. And, you know, certainly that's done in the performance, that's done in the music and the sound design. But how are you incorporating that into cinematography?
For us, it was mostly about, well, two things. Number one, for Jackie, from a point of view, we wanted to be with her and her point of view. So there's a lot of like following shots so that we're kind of experiencing her journey and her uncertainty and her like this process of self-discovery, literally. So that the camera's always kind of from her point of view, it's always following her, it's always with her, I think number one. And then I think number two is the idea that the camera never settles. Through that storyline, we always try to keep the camera probing. And even if it's, you know, subtly and subconscious, there's always this like subtle movement. So that you never, you know, the idea that you never kind of get your feet on the ground and to enhance that uncertainty. And hopefully that was contrast with Temple and the Geist building where the camera was more set and deliberate and more objective rather than subjective like with Jackie. So, I mean, those were some conscious decisions that we tried to put in those two storylines to help keep that kind of unsettled feeling, particularly with Jackie.
The camera movement in Homecoming is... it's just spectacular. I mean, your use of camera movement is really, really good. And like you said, it never kind of stops. Like it's you're always moving through a scene in a way. And it's interesting to hear you say that sort of lends to the unsettling, which kind of makes sense because you're never really settled as you're viewing the scene. But they're also really elegant. Like a lot of times people will create fear and anxiety in film and filmmaking with kind of shaky cameras and high frame rates, and they're kind of moving around all over the place. You guys have that same kind of fearful feeling with these slow, elegant kind of, I can't think of the word, but there's the slowness and the elegance in the camera move is also creating this sense of weary.
Right.
And I think it's just a really great use of movement. Can you talk to us a little bit more about the way you've moved the camera and maybe a scene or two that, you know, really illustrates that?
Sure. I mean, yeah, you're right. I think that we called it creepy. We wanted the camera always to be creeping or creepy. Yeah. creep was an adjective that was thrown around quite a bit, for the purpose of creating tension. There were, quite a few moments where we tried to capture that. I think even in the opening sequence where Jackie's at night and she's climbing out of the forest and we're pulling back with her through the woods. And this was all, and I guess technically, I'll tell you how we did it. It was like we're on a techno crane. And I mean, in this like very difficult location up in Lake Arrowhead, where we had like a 30-foot techno crane. And then it's like literally armed off this precipice, following Jackie up this hill. And then she arrives at the road. It's at night. There's one car. There's a lone street light. You know, and we talked about doing this in cuts and all these different variations. And I think at the end of the day, Kyle and I were like, let's try to speak to what you're talking about, to keep rather than doing it in cuts, let's try to keep this creepy element to it where the camera just settles with her when she lands, she turns away, she has this I don't know what you call it, the car remote,
I guess. The unlock car thing.
Yes. So she tries
to do that. That's what it's called technically. It's called the unlock car thing. This thing.
That's about as technical as I get with camera equipment as well. So we're right on course.
Oh,
bring the flux capacitor.
Exactly.
Anyway, so she continues down the road, and then the techno crane, it was on a drivable base. So as she's walking down the road, once again, to get into that very subjective viewpoint, we're following with her from behind her. We're seeing what she's seeing. We're experiencing what she's seeing. And we telescope out, and then the camera starts to move on the base. And then as she walks off into the distance, we start to boom up. So, that was one idea where we wanted to, rather than doing it cuts, rather than being handheld, let's just keep this very fluid, very meditative, very creepy camera move that continues. And let's, try to come up with some tools and ways and means of carrying that shot out through the entire sequence.
Did you have the techno crane with you the entire series or the entire season?
No, we day played it. I mean, we of course had it often. I think we had a couple days away, a couple days a week. One thing that we used almost daily, which was a carryover from season one and something that I gleaned from Todd in our conversations, is we used the Oculus head, a remote head on the dolly, and shot quite a bit of the show on that device, in particular these kind of flowing and long sequence shots. So that was a heavy lifting device.
So hold on, I'm looking it up right now. The Oculus head on, you just had that on the dolly, so you had control over the pan and tilt and all that. You basically could control it and just use that as your, that's your crane, the dolly.
Absolutely, it was our dolly, exactly. And so any tracking shots, and the beauty of the Oculus head is such an amazing piece of equipment is that often, if we are in, for example, here's a good example, is in the hospital set. Like we never laid track, and we have all these very long probing 360 degree shots sometimes that are all done with Mark Gellner, super talented operator, tucked away in the corner. And it's just the dolly grip, Kyle Cardigan with the camera, with the head, and able to move, do these, fairly complex orchestrated moves without the cumbersome of having, track or dance floor or things like that.
Watching the first episode, I was thinking to myself, I'm like, okay, I know there's going to be an overhead shot. There has to be. This is homecoming. There's got to be a cool overhead shot. And you deliver it at the end through the hotel when you're going from, I can't remember the room you're going from, but you go from one room to Jackie's room. And I just want to talk about the logistics of something like that. Are you on a stage? I'm assuming you have to be in order to have that access. But talk to me about the logistics of one of those really kind of creamy, smooth overhead shots that are sort of like a necessity for homecoming.
Right. Well, I will say this, Kyle Alvarez, which is probably a big part of the reason, one of the reasons he's doing season two is that we've done a couple movies together, and the overhead moving shot is kind of a staple of Kyle's as well. So we have a little bit of a track record in coming into the homecoming world. But, that scene in particular, and I think it's also part of season one, is designing the sets, which is a big component to accommodate those type of shots. And of course, they did it on a massive scale for season one. And season two is a little bit more on location. It doesn't have the homecoming facility. But that being said, I think almost every set we had some type of design element that would facilitate us being able to do either overhead shots or tracking shots, you know, some component to facilitate that. And that one in particular, we had, you know, the hotel was designed to accommodate us being able to get a crane in, once again, a techno crane, over the set to allow for us, you know, to do the shot. And once again, we talked about different ways of doing it, whether it be a cable cam or some kind of truss system. But I think in the end, we put a techno crane on a, we built it up on a platform over the set and simply like, you know, it was on a zoom lens as well, which added some complication. But to start in the bedroom, come into the bathroom, and then be able to arm in and zoom in at the same time down to Jackie at the sink as she's kind of discovering that this tattoo she has is not real. And so to incorporate, you know, a tracking, a zooming, a booming, and a spinning all into one shot, it's fairly complicated, you know. And on screen, you look at it and you're like, oh, it's not that, you know, it's how interesting. But then it's like trying to actually come up with the way to accomplish that shot is, you know, no small feat. But we had an amazing crew that were, to this day, I'm just like, I don't know how they pulled half this stuff off.
How much on location work did you do this season?
I would say we were probably 2/3 of the time on location.
Wow.
Versus on stage. Yeah. Quite a bit of location work.
That's a lot. Yeah. So how do you keep, I mean, all the things we're talking about, unique camera movements, interesting shots, all of that. I mean, there's going to be so much more limitations on locations than if you build a set to suit. So how are you accommodating for that?
Even the location sets, I think like, well, there's the Geist farm, for example, like that was on location, but we did build the farmhouse. So I think that there were elements even on practical location that we constructed or crafted or engineered to facilitate those shots. For example, like we're on this big farm, you know, with this farmhouse, and we have, I think it's the end of episode one where we're starting, or episode two, I'm not sure, we're on Geist, he's in the farm fields, and we, of course, there's Chris Cooper, and we pull back through the farmhouse with him and come out the other side and come up to reveal the big estate of the farm.
I think that's the end of episode one.
Is it? Okay.
I'm looking at it right now. Because you're coming through, you go through the two doors of the farm, like you're completely go through it.
Right.
That's not stitched at all, right? Or is it? Or is that just, is that one fluid motion?
There is one stitch in that shot. I mean, the original idea was we tried to do it in one shot, but to get a, you know, it's a crane with a zoom and a, you know,
yeah,
and to get all the way out there from a close-up of him all the way to the big wide shot at the end, we ended up doing it and there's a stitch as you come out the back door to facilitate getting, be able to get the camera back far enough.
It's such a cool shot. I'm watching it right now and it's just such a great way of revealing an environment.
It speaks to what you said before of like, how can we tell this in one like creepy, fluid, deliberate shot rather than cuts. And that's another example where the set was designed in such a way to facilitate that shot. So Kyle had this idea of wanting to do this shot, you know, before this place was ever built. We're out in the middle of a pasture basically, or a field. And so it's like, okay, how can we build this house and how can we put the camera and how can we move it through the house? And, you know, you go through all the different options and variables and of how to facilitate that. But yes, there is a stitch and then the camera pulls out and comes out the back door and booms up. You see the full farm.
We've had a lot of our listeners, when they ask questions of our guests, there's a lot of talk about like prep. People in the Go Creative Show audience want to get a better sense of how, you know, DPs at your level are preparing for their shoots. Can you give us a little bit of a breakdown of how you prepare for a scene?
Well, I'm a fairly obsessive prepper. And I like to usually go in. And, you know, directors are different. And I work with a lot of different directors. Some directors who really don't like to prep at all and like to come in on the day and like to find it. And you know, I don't have really any, I embrace that kind of approach as well. Homecoming is a little different in the fact that everything is so deliberate and so meticulous that we spent a lot of time prepping. Kyle and I storyboarded, I would say at least a third, if not half of the show, and worked with two or three different storyboard artists. All super talented, so that we, you know, because we were boarding so much. So everything was very deliberate and crafted. That being said, we still would show up on the set and we would, you know, there would be room for inspiration and changes and adjustments and things like that. And Kyle was a very intuitive filmmaker and, you know, he always has set ideas on the day. But at least it gives us a really strong, especially on a show like this, where it is so stylistic and sometimes the camera moves are so complicated. Is a jumping off point and lets us make sure that, you know, we're prepared to execute technically these particular shots and this particular type coverage.
So it sounds like he is a big fan of prepping as well, if he's kind of working with you on these storyboards.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And I think it's great too. I mean, Kyle and I have done this is our third project together. I think we've done two movies before. So there's definitely a shorthand that has developed over the years. And I think the time that we have in prep at this point is, you know, because of the shorthand and because of a shared language, is very productive and very effective.
Do you create previs?
We did not create any previs for this. We talked about it in some of the, I think there's a shot around the house in season two where Jackie goes and does a full camera, does a full 360 around this entire house and goes in and out of the house.
Yeah.
I think we ended up just primarily using storyboards almost exclusively.
Do you get a lot of time with the actors ahead of time? Like when you're doing these rehearsals and you have big stars like Janelle Monáe, like, are you just using stand-ins for your rehearsals? Are they there for rehearsals? What is the normal protocol for something like that?
I'm not too actively involved in rehearsals. I know Kyle had a decent amount of rehearsal time. I think a week or two leading into production, he had a fair amount of rehearsal time, but I think it was mostly, the rehearsals were mostly for performance and for character.
I'm surprised you didn't get a lot of rehearsal because there's so much very specific camera movement in the season.
Right. No, we didn't. You know, we would more often than not, when we had very specific shots, and Janelle Monáe is amazing. And like, I mean, you know, to be able to show up on set and go, we would, you know, talk through what we wanted to do. And she would often like come up with ideas that would add to the shot, you know, like take it to the next level, which was just so amazing. But she was so incredibly collaborative and would come in and we would talk through a complicated shot and then she would go, well, what if we did this or that? And we would incorporate it. And then we would rehearse it with a stand-in who was amazing. And then, you know, really dial it in. Janelle would come in, watch the rehearsal once we, you know, because it takes some time to set these shots up.
Sure.
Janelle, she would watch the rehearsal and then she would jump in and we'd start shooting it with her. And I mean, it ended up being a very kind of fluid, organic process and collaborative. And I think that allowed us to get some of the, you know, the more interesting stuff.
What's it like working with Janelle Monáe? I mean, obviously I knew her from music first, and I think that right. was where she started. And it's just so exciting to see her transition into acting. She's so good. Like she's such
so
a good performer. I've always been a fan of her music regardless, but now seeing her on screen is so exciting. This is the first project I've seen where she's the lead in it. I know she's done other stuff, but this just happens to be the first thing I saw.
No, I had a similar experience. I know her music and she's just such a great personality. And when I heard that she was in this season and the lead of the season, I was like, that Janelle Monáe? Like there was a bit of a confusion. And then I think that I saw Hidden Figures and she's in Hidden Figures. I don't know if you had the opportunity.
I haven't seen it, no, but yeah.
She is so incredibly good in that movie. Just incredible. Anyway, she is such a great human being, which, you know, I wish I could say that of all actors and unfortunately I can't, but she's like, just, she is amazing. And she is so incredibly generous and so incredibly collaborative and so incredibly professional. I mean, she's like, she like watches her takes and like, she is there, to make the best product art, call it what you will, possible.
Yeah.
And, it's nice to have, you know, Kyle and I, and obviously the whole crew are just insanely committed to the point of obsession, and to have her come in and join that obsession level with us was fantastic.
Let's talk about gear, cameras, okay. lights, all of it. Let's get into it. Homecoming season two, what were you shooting on? Let's talk about your camera and your lens set.
We shot with a very similar camera package in season one. We used the Panavision DXL, which is a camera that I love and have shot with for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, almost exclusively at this point.
Did you test anything else or you were just like, that's the package we're using?
You know, because I've been using it exclusively and because Todd had used it on season one and it was like, there was really no discussion. Like that was mm-hmm. what we were going to do. Lenses, we used the G-Series Anamorphics, which were also used on season one, which were heavily modified by Dan Sasaki. And so we used a similar recipe for our detuning. I don't know if Panavision likes to call it detuning. I think their new is like enhancement or something. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure what their political word is, but anyway, they're modified.
Yeah, I think anybody that comes from a music background is going to appreciate the word detune, but I think anything else, it sounds like you're messing it up for some reason.
Yeah.
But I'm hearing that a lot. A lot of people are getting these, they're I guess they're custom lenses, but they're like lenses with some tweaks to it that are particular to the show that they're working on. This is something I'm hearing more and more of when we interview people on the show.
I think so too. I mean, I think it seems to be a very, at least at Panavision, it's a very common practice and everywhere else as well, but like, you know, softening the edges, softening the contrast, adding, defocusing certain areas of the frame. So we were doing quite a bit of that, which is fairly evident in season one. I mean, I think you see a lot of the soft focus elements in the top and the bottom of the frame.
Yep.
And generally the softening of the contrast of the lenses. So we had, we tested it with our I call it our blue LUT, which is kind of that Jackie LUT we were talking about, and kind of very similar modification to our lenses as well. So Panavision DXL with G-series lenses. We had a couple zoom lenses that we had on.
I love those zoom shots because you just don't see them anymore. Like they're
so good.
They really get your attention when you have that really kind of cool, interesting zoom in. It just, you just don't see it.
Right. And I think, Kyle's really good with the zooms too. And we used them in Stanford Prison Experiment quite a bit, but like doing them in a way where almost you don't even realize you're watching it a zoom until you're like, wait a second, that whole shot was a dolly with a zoom and that was it. There's no other coverage in the scene. But he has the ability to really use it in kind of, I think, a very kind of elegant, subtle way that doesn't like smack you over the head.
Yes. And it's weird because yes, it is derivative of another time, certainly, but it's not used in like a hokey way. Like it never feels cheesy. It always feels purposeful and also fresh, which is hard to do with a move like that.
It really is. And that it's like to take something like that, that was really kind of like you said, more of an antiquated film language. But they don't, even in Homecoming season one and season two, I feel like it feels very contemporary, which I don't know why, but I agree with you.
Good craftsmanship. That's what it is. It's you guys behind the camera making it good. What was the zoom lens you were using?
I don't remember specifically. Unfortunately, I'd have to look at the books, but we had a short zoom that we used. And then we had like an 11:1, like a 48:480, some like ginormous 11:1 zoom as well. And I think the wide one was like maybe a 15:40.
Yeah.
But we shot primarily on the primes, on the G series. And we really only went to the zoom lenses unless we needed the really long focal length or it was, specifically a zoom move crafted into the shot.
Now, I want to talk about collaboration for editors. Any of you guys that are editing out there, you know that collaboration can sometimes be a little bit tricky, right? No longer. Because of PostLab. PostLab is the tool you need for Final Cut Pro 10 and Premiere to make your editing collaboration seamless. There's a few things to mention. First, access, okay? Besides always saving all of your documents locally, PostLab syncs all the changes to your entire team wherever they are. So you're not zipping up and emailing documents back and forth. Those days are over. You also never have broken files because, as you know, two people working on the same file at the same time is an accident waiting to happen. But PostLab makes sure that never happens. And lastly, Time Machine 2.0. Think about this. You can browse the history of each library, jump back and forth between versions, find the apps, the particular edit that you're looking for, all super quick. You can open it up exactly as you left it, down to where the playhead was left. Now, if that does not entice you, then you have not edited before, right? Cool thing is PostLab works for Final Cut Pro 10 and Premiere now. And you get 3 months free by going to gocreativeshow.com/PostLab. gocreativeshow.com/PostLab. Revolutionize the way that you collaborate with your editing tools. This is what you need. PostLab. gocreativeshow.com/PostLab and get 3 free months. Did you have a DIT on set with you all the time throughout the entire series?
I did. I have a DIT, Brett Sitting, who I've worked with for years, super talented. And I honestly don't know how I would go to work without him being there. It would be tragic. But yes. And I think it was, we talked about actually doing the season without a DIT, but then because the contrast in the looks between the storylines was such an important component of the show. I think that was the driving factor. It's like that we definitely need somebody to help us manage those two looks. You know, like season one had different aspect ratios. Season two, we have two different looks.
Yeah.
And so having Brett to help facilitate that and to massage the two LUTs and manage the two looks was critical.
I'm always shocked when people have shows without it. It just seems like it's so essential to have that. And maybe it's a cost savings thing, but at the same time, it's like, my God, that's what you're doing. That's what you're creating. Like you need, that needs to be good.
I did a Showtime. No, was it Showtime? No, it was Netflix. I did a Netflix project last year that we ended up not using a DIT for the show itself. And I don't know that I've ever done it. And I was like, well, you know,
what was the project?
I was like, why not? Let's try it. It was called, Mixtape originally, but I think it evolved into, you know, the name evolved into Soundtrack.
Okay.
And it was interesting from a work experience because it was almost like shooting film in a way, because there is no DIT and you're not using DIT, the tent and the monitors to set exposure and things like that. So, you know, you have this, in essence, you know, one LUT that you're using. And which was interesting in terms of the workflow, but I would have to say, I really think that the look of the show suffered downstream by not having a DIT. Mm. And, you know, and part of that's television as well, and not being able to be there for all the color timing sessions like you would necessarily on a movie. But being able to communicate what your intention is all the way down the pipe through color timing, there's definitely some misfiring. So I think there was, you know, unfortunately, wasn't quite as good as it could have been with the DIT.
So you're saying just TV schedule, the way things work with TV, the director of photography wouldn't be as involved in color as you may be in a film. And because of that, you want to have a DIT the whole time so that you can maintain your vision throughout the entire series. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think so. I think if I were to do another TV show, I would and if they didn't want to use a DIT, I would advocate for it. Because yes, on a movie, you are paid to go into color timing. You're almost, you know, it's the third part of the job on a movie, in my experience. You know, you have your pre-production, you have your production, and then you have the final color. In TV, the DPs aren't often, at least in my experience, and I could be, you know, I have a limited experience, aren't involved in color timing. I'm certainly not, and I wasn't Homecoming, but I certainly, you know, wasn't paid to be there as I would on a movie. So you do have, I think it is important to be able to establish that look that flows down the pipeline in TV. So if I was in that situation again, like on Mixtape Soundtrack, I would definitely advocate for a DIT.
Let's talk about the lighting choices for Homecoming. What kind of lighting package were you rolling with on a regular basis? Did you have a particular philosophy that you used in Homecoming throughout the season?
Well, I was enormously lucky to have Chris Colleton, who was the gaffer on season one, do season two.
Nice.
Which was amazing. And this dude is like insanely talented, insanely attentive, insanely creative.
And insane.
Without a doubt, definitely insane too. No doubt about it. And he would probably be the first to admit it. So that's good. But, you know, the lighting in general, for all the scenes that kind of follow the path of season one, the Geist headquarters, Redwood, we really tried to follow a similar lighting approach they did on season one. Very sun-kissed, a lot of specular highlights. And then that contrast with Jackie's storyline, which was a little more muted in terms of the lighting, not as specular, a lot more fluorescent, a lot of broader sources. Although we still try to build in a lot of shadow details, like even when, you know, we're in environments like in the hospital, for example, which is, you know, traditional overhead fluorescent lighting. Like we definitely worked hard to like turn off lights, build in negative fill to really build in some mood into those scenes. So I would say, you know, the differences are that you know, the environments like Geist that are season one definitely have that kind of sun-kissed specular look, but had this more soft yet still moody look to the Jackie storyline.
As far as the lighting fixtures though, what are you heavily relying on? LED? Are you using a lot of practicals? Are you using a lot of, tungsten? What are you using?
Chris has these great, I would say almost, they're LED lights. He calls them pancake lights, I think. They're stuff that he's custom made and they come in various sizes. But in general, they're like a 2x3 LED panel that have a snoot that you can fit grids into. And they're pretty amazing and they're pretty versatile. And you can change the color temperature, if I'm not mistaken, and you can certainly change the intensity. And he has these in all these various sizes. So those were kind of the heavy lifting workhorse of this show. And then aside from that, we used a lot of really big broad sources like 18Ks, whether direct or through diffusion. So I think, I feel like that was it. It was like really big HMI or tungsten sources, you know, 20Ks and 18Ks. And then not much, you know, like you would normally see is like babies and tweenies and things like that. So it went from like, you know, big HMIs and big tungsten units to these LED pancake lights and sky panels and things like that.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the range of what we're using. We used a little bit of a, you know, most of the time, if even if it was, you know, like Walter is in, I don't think this is in the first couple episodes, but he's in like the veteran's office, which is overhead lighting, but also has some light coming through windows. So I felt like even when we were in locations that were very kind of practically lit driven, there was still a lot of supplementation going on, a lot of modeling. I mean, the lighting, in my opinion, is equally as stylized as the camera work is.
Yeah.
So we tried to maintain that as well. So, you know, we definitely took some creative license with, you know, light, with direction of light and contrast and things like that. So I don't know how natural it appears, but it hopefully at least services the style of the show.
Well, I'm looking at the hospital scene right now again, and I mean, you're 100% right. Like, there's a lot of modeling going on in there. Even, you know, it's like you feel that it's top lit. Like, you, mm-hmm. you understand where you are. There's nothing about it that doesn't look natural, but it is so much more dramatic than a real hospital would be in its lighting. And I think, like you were talking about the negative fill aspect of it, I guess, how are you creating, how are you molding and shaping light in an environment where it really just naturally would be overhead lights? Like, my last interview was Eric Messerschmidt from Mindhunter. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And he was like on the complete opposite side of the spectrum, where it's like natural, 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 natural. Overhead. It is what it is. And I mean, that show looks amazing, obviously.
Absolutely.
But like, he took such a crazy natural approach and sort of flattened everything out, and it looks really good. I feel like mm-hmm. you guys have a lot of shape in your light, and even in areas where you think it would be flat, like the hospital, it still has this really great modeling to it. Talk to me about how you're achieving that.
Well, practically in that situation, like, you have the overhead lighting, which is already built into the set. And so really it's, you know, and I think this is often the case for me anyway, it's like, it's almost about what you turn off rather than what you turn on in terms mm-hmm. of lighting. So any lights that are in frame are obviously on, and you leave certain lights that are lighting the character on, diffuse them. Like, we would, like, for example, if we were to have, you know, a shot of Jackie, for example, what in essence would be a side light. We would heavily put a big diffusion diaper on it. So that, in essence, becomes our key light. We might supplement it a little bit with something else, like one of these pancake lights. Mm. Not pancake, they're waffle lights. And I just remembered, waffle lights.
Talking about the grid, the waffle grid in front of yeah. of the light? Okay, okay. I was looking, as you're saying that, I'm looking up pancake light, and there are things that are pancake lights, but so yeah. you're just talking about there's that waffle grid in front of the source.
Well, no, he literally calls these lights waffle lights. And it is like a 1x2 or 2x3. It is like a square light source, like a light panel that's diffused and has a snoot on it that Chris has made. And
oh, wow.
Lights. Yeah. And he calls them waffle lights. Anyway, so we would like have like an overhead source that's heavily diffused with a big diaper on it, maybe have a waffle light to supplement. And then, I mean, we would like turn off all the lights behind camera and like have 4x floppies, 8x solids. Like, we would just do everything humanly possible to create shadow side. And I think Chris and I, at one point, like, I think there's a cartoon called Doonesbury, maybe, and I could be mispronouncing it, that is like the characters are always like silhouetted. And so we always had this idea of like, how can we Doonesbury this shot up or this lighting setup and like create a strong shadow side? So there was the building in the contrast was is equally important as, like, you know, figuring out where our key light would be and you know, the source of the light and things like that. So it was a conscious effort to constantly trying to build in this like shadow side, silhouettes, things of that nature.
I'm looking up Doonesbury comics right here as we're talking, and yeah, there's a lot of silhouette in there. That's it.
Yes. Yeah. So I guess at the end of the day, our main lighting reference for Homecoming season 2 was Doonesbury. If you want to tell it like it is, that's the fact.
Never would have thought that, but this is hilarious. I love that. Yes. I love that. All right. I got a couple of just very specific questions about scenes in the season.
Sure.
Episode 2, there's a shot of Jackie breaking into Audrey Temple's home. The camera follows her around the outside of the house. I think you brought it up just as a reference a couple minutes ago. Can you talk to us about kind of how you achieved that shot?
I would say one of my first conversations with Kyle about the show, when I met with him, he's like, I want to do this shot that goes all the way around this house, into the house, and comes out in one continuous shot.
Yeah.
Like, it was an idea he had from the beginning, like one of our first conversations.
So start with what are the challenges to make that happen? I mean, some of the obvious, like exposure, reflections, all of those things.
Oh yeah.
What are you thinking when you try to make this shot? What are the challenges?
Well, I would say it was probably, we had more meetings and spent more time on this shot than any other sequence in the entire movie. I mean, because it's obviously a big collaboration with the art department. So practically the shot was done on location and on stage, and we married the shot together.
Wow.
So it's like, okay, we have this exterior component on location, then we have this house that we're building on set that we're going to be shooting in practically for the show. But then we also have to build it in such a way that we can accommodate this full 360-degree travel around through the house. So it was multiple meetings of heavy collaboration with the production designer, Nora, about how can we build this house. And we ended up designing the house in such a way that the entire kitchen back half of the house was removable.
Wow.
So we shot in the house for a week. And then at the end of the week, they removed this entire back portion of the house so that as we travel around the house, we can have the illusion that the camera's going inside when actually it's still outside. So it was a very collaborative effort. And I don't know how deep in the weeds you want to go with it, but yes. So it's like the shot starts outside. It's on Steadicam. It drops on a crane. Our Mark stepped off the crane, followed Jackie to the house. And then as she goes into the backyard, there's a gate, this very coveted gate door that she goes through, which was the first stitch that helps us get from bridge from being on location to on set.
Yeah.
And this gate was pivotal because we had to match the exact gate. So there was many discussions of where this gate is and what it is so that we can have the same gate on location, the same one we have on stage. And once you go through that gate, then we transition through a stitch into our stage location, which was, we broke it up really into two shots. One that gets her as she's kind of going around the house and climbs through the window. And once she goes through the window, then there's a stitch there, almost a wipe as she transitions into the kitchen, in which the camera visually is in the house with her at that point and transitions all the way out. And the reason we broke it into two shots is obviously the choreography of the performance with the actress, also the lighting, like we shifted the lighting both in the shot as well as going from what I call the A side and the B side as she goes into the house. So the lighting kind of, once again, to keep the Doonesbury effect, because we don't want to lose that. So you know,
yeah,
as we come around, we change the direction of the lighting so it's more backlit, silhouette, etc. And then there was, as you suggested, many discussions of the windows and how we get through. Certain windows have glass in them, certain don't, because obviously the reflection issues. So I don't know, it's fairly complex.
It's just incredible.
I'm completely rambling about if it makes any sense, but that's kind of.
I'm watching the scene as you talk, and it is just incredible. When I mean, shots like these are always amazing. People love the idea of a one-er shot and what you're able to get done in them, but this takes it to a different level, and it's just absolutely gorgeous. So it's cool to see that it's a combination of on set and also an actual location, which is, it's pretty wild.
Yeah.
I love stuff like that.
And well, also too, I think it's interesting too, you know, like season one had these amazing wonders, and Kyle and I, when we started first talking about this, we're like, for us, this is the kind of shot that, you know, a wonder that if you're watching the show, you might not even notice this a wonder. And that's a very intentional. It's like, we don't want it to call attention to itself to the point where it takes you out of the story.
Yeah.
We want to make sure that you're in the moment and the tension that Jackie has by going to this house is maintained. So that was kind of, once again, goes back to our original conversation of keeping this creepy, probing, subjective point of view and how can we make that fit into this shot. So that was really the directive, you know, not so much as technically being able to pull off this wonder, but how can we sustain this suspense and this tension?
Yeah. Well, the series is phenomenal. Season two held up all the expectations that I had, and I came in with a lot of expectations. Cool. Homecoming, season two, May 22nd on Amazon Prime. Jess Shelton, thank you so much for being on Go Creative Show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
What's next for you?
I don't know. You know, we might go back and do this pilot that got shut down. It was for Showtime called Big Deal with Michael Showalter directing. And like, we were literally 2 weeks out from shooting. So I've heard a few rumors of that maybe coming back this summer and might be doing that. Otherwise, I don't know. I do have this independent movie that I am doing with my longtime friend and collaborator, Lance Larson, called Deadland, which we're shooting on film. It's an independent movie. It's a small budget. It's like, you know, $1.5 million. But we're shooting on 16 millimeter in New Mexico. And we were actually set to shoot that in June. Actors attached, ready to go. And that obviously is getting pushed off, I think, until September, maybe. Anyway, so I'm super excited about that. I co-wrote it with Lance. We're producing it together. And it's going to be a very interesting, unusual. It's like a mixed genre, you know, ghost story, horror story. I don't want to get too much, but it's, I'm very excited about that.
Oh, that's awesome. All right. Well, we have that to look forward to as well. Jazz Shelton, thank you so much for being on. Stay safe out there. And my God, hopefully Hollywood gets back up and running soon.
Thank you. Have a great day.
I want to thank Jazz Shelton for coming on the show today and talking about Homecoming Season 2. Guys, I'm telling you, watch this show. Season 1 was amazing. Season 2 is amazing. You are going to love it. It's definitely a show for cinematographers, for sure. You guys are going to love it. I also want to thank Matt Russell for mixing and mastering and making the show sound so good. You can find him at gainstructure.com, at gainstructure on Twitter. And of course, our producer, Connor Crosby, at Ignition Visuals, ignitionvisuals.com. Of course, you can find me at Ben Consoli on your favorite social media apps. I'm there, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. I don't have a TikTok yet, but there's too many. I can't do anymore. And of course, gocreativeshow.com. For all things Go Creative Show, the show notes from today's episode and all previous episodes, you can subscribe to us there. You can follow us all over the place. It's the place to go. Of course, I want to thank our sponsors, MZ Education for Creatives, and PostLab, stress-free collaboration for Final Cut Pro 10 and Premiere. Without these people, the show wouldn't exist, so please support those that support us, and we'll see you next week on another episode of Go Creative Show, a podcast for filmmakers.